Today, we're doing something a little different. We're looking back at a recorded conversation with activist, professor, and author Angela Davis, who came here earlier this month thanks to the Kroc School Institute for Peace and Justice as part of the Distinguished Lecture Series to talk about the history of the U.S. justice system, radical feminism, and the role of imagination in social justice work. To give some context, Professor Davis grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. It was her community that experienced the loss of the four little girls who died in the infamous bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church in 1963. Her city was named Bombingham because of the ongoing bombings motivated by racism. She grew up impacted by the violence of racism and has worked her whole life against racist terrorism, racist institutions, and working towards reforging justice in a deeper sense. At one point, she was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. For 18 months, she was in jail and was on the path towards death row. And she was acquitted and walked free. Professor Davis is now a distinguished professor emerita of History of Consciousness, an interdisciplinary PhD program, and of feminist studies. Throughout her lifelong career, she has focused on racial, economic, and gender justice in communities of concern. Davis focuses on liberation for LGBTQ+ rights, the Black community, and for those who are incarcerated. Having helped to popularize the notion of a prison industrial complex, Davis now urges her audience to think seriously about the future possibility of a world without prisons and to help forge a 21st century abolitionist movement. Today, I have with me the two co-moderators of Professor Davis's talk, Watana Tucker, a lawyer who has worked in the California Department of Corrections for over a decade and who serves on the Kroc School's Board of Advisors, and Hallie Schilling, a Kroc School student in the Conflict Management and Resolution Program and the producer of this podcast, Is the World on Fire? Welcome.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much.
In a few minutes, you will be listening to the talk by Professor Davis. But in the meantime, will you tell us a little bit about what it was like to be on stage with Professor Davis?
Well, for starters, I would say that having her on campus, knowing that she was coming, was very much like having a rock star here, which she would hate. She would hate to be described that way, but there's no getting around it. She is such a well-known figure to people who've devoted their lives to the practice of social justice. But at the same time, she is such a practitioner extraordinaire. I mean, she has been putting out fires for 50 years, but she has so much experience doing the hard work, the demonstrating, the organizing, the marching, the making signs, the telling people to go to meetings, that it's important to have someone like her on campus. So when you have a group of people who've, you know, devoted their time to learning how to be peacemakers, learning how to be change makers, it's so wonderful to have someone who's been doing it for so long. And it was wonderful. The audience could not get enough of her, and rightfully so. What did you think, Watana?
Well, as an advisory board member, it was important to have the community be part of that discussion. As excited as the Kroc School and USD and the students and faculty were, certainly the community was as well. And so part of my experience was having a lot of friends call and say, I can't get tickets. And me say, that's because she sold out in less than 2 hours. And there's a reason for that. She walks the walk, as you said, Hallie. She has a level of intellectual discourse about some of the most unsettling topics that we confront with her, as opposed to being confronted by her. And it was an extraordinary evening.
I agree. And I hope everyone enjoys what's coming next.
All right. Well, let's get into it. Hallie, Watana, thank you for joining us today. For our listeners, stay tuned to our next episode where we'll have more time to interview Watana about her experience working with people who are incarcerated. Without further ado, enjoy this special episode of Is the World on Fire with Professor Angela Davis.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Professor Davis, it is a pleasure to have you back in San Diego.
Well, good evening, everyone.
You've been working on the issue of prisons for decades. I'm sure your thinking about this has evolved over the years. Right now, what are your views on prisons in the U.S.? What are the most important messages on prisons that you'd like to share with this audience tonight?
Before I address the first question, I can't guarantee you that I will answer it fully. Let me say what an honor it is to have been invited to participate in this conversation by the Kroc School for Peace and Justice. You know, I went to graduate school in San Diego at UCSD. So I'm experiencing a flood of memories now. But the question about prisons, I've had some relationship to the topic virtually all of my life. You know, whether it's activist work around prisons, I actually ended up spending quite some time in jail as a result of the work that I was doing on political prisoners. So that's pretty much been the theme of my life. But what I will say in response to the question you posed is that I never expected abolition, prison abolition, which also embraces the abolition of other carceral institutions. It involves reimagining what forms of safety and security we need. I never imagined there would be a widespread public discourse on abolition. When I first began working around this issue, we would talk sometime. And let me say that all of the work that I've ever done has always been with others, so I cannot take credit for it as an individual. I want to say that from the outset. But I can remember conversations in which we imagined ourselves as doing work that would probably never really resonate during our lifetimes, but that would plant some seeds and would be taken up generations later. And so when the pandemic happened, when the collectively witnessed lynching of George Floyd happened, at a time when we were all in retreat, pretty much, it created a set of circumstances that allowed people to think more deeply. Of course, we could spend the entire evening, you know, talking about the implications of what happened in the summer of 2020. But it was a conjunctural moment that created a very new collective consciousness. And for a while, because of course many people now are upset because they characterize what we are experiencing now as a backlash. But I want to perhaps address that you know, by saying that history doesn't unfold ever in a linear fashion. You never go from one step to the second step to the third step. You know, sometimes it's two steps backward before you even take one step forward. But all of this is to say that this new collective consciousness around carceral issues and around slavery, because that was, I think, really, I think what we experienced in the summer of 2020 was an awareness, although maybe not so explicit, but an awareness that our forebears did not do the work that would have been required to fully abolish slavery. And that is what we witnessed and experienced in the summer of 2020. And it's not accidental that it happened in connection with issues of policing and issues of imprisonment, because both imprisonment and policing have roots in slavery. So I'm really excited now, even though everybody is talking about the backlash, but we should have been able to foresee that there would be resistance. If you set out to do something and actually accomplish it, then it's inevitable that there will be response, that there will be resistance, that there will be backlash. I guess the point I'm making now is that I don't think we're completely removed from that conjuncture. We're still pretty much trying to work it out, even though those who have louder voices are attempting to ban books and change school curricula and, you know, do all kinds of things in response to what was represented by the fact that vast numbers of people in this country, more than ever before in the history of this country, went out and demonstrated, went out into the streets at a time when none of us knew how the virus was being transmitted. So what makes that so phenomenal is that people went out in the streets even though they recognized that it might cost them their lives. And I emphasize this because I think we have to keep this in our historical memory. The moment may no longer be here per se, but as I said before, I still think that we're in that conjuncture, and we haven't really resolved it.
In Our Prisons Obsolete, you write that prison seems so natural that it's hard to imagine life without it. Getting back to the first part of your answer, in the last question, in the same way slavery was once considered natural, how can we work to shift people's view so that they don't see prisons and incarceration as inevitable, as part of the fabric of the society? And I have a follow-up question from one of our incarcerated persons. And this person specifically asks, a lot of the COs, which are custody officers, guards, in California state prisons, become as institutionalized as the inmates. How can the United States of America ever abolish prisons when the people who run them are so invested in the status quo?
Well, you know, those are two really complicated questions. But I want to try to offer a simple answer. And that simple answer is education. It is critical thinking. And it involves the recognition that it's our responsibility to question everything. And especially to question that which appears to be beyond the realm of questioning. That is to say, that which appears to be the most normal aspects. It's not going to be a simple effort. It's repeating over and over again. I was just looking at someone's copy, whom I signed the copy, Amanda. There you are, right there. I was just looking at her copy of a book that I wrote called Our Prisons Obsolete that you mentioned. And I couldn't remember, I can never remember the dates of publication of my books, but it was 2003. In 2003, there was a group of what we used to call prison activists who were attempting to move beyond reform, because the whole history of the institution, of the prison, is also the history of efforts to reform the prison. As a matter of fact, Michel Foucault, in his book Discipline and Punish, points out that that exactly captures the history of the institution of the prison, that is to say, the history of the efforts to challenge it and to make it better. I was thinking, wow, in 2003, that was about 5 years after a major conference that we organized in the Bay Area on the campus of UC Berkeley, which was called Critical Resistance Beyond the Prison Industrial Complex. And it was interesting that the group of 25 of us or so who did the organizing for the conference had associated ourselves with earlier abolitionist efforts. Because abolition emerges, well, I can't tell you the entire, I taught an entire seminar on the history of abolition, but I'll say that in the U.S., in the aftermath of the Attica Rebellion in 1971, there was a pretty powerful abolitionist consciousness that emerged, where prominent people wrote editorials in the New York Times urging consideration of the abolition of prisons. This was a movement that was largely led by Quakers. And, I mean, that'll be interesting to people who are in the Kroc School for Peace and Justice. That just as Quakers had, interestingly, invented imprisonment as a humane mode of punishment, because they challenged the capital punishment and corporal punishment, and suggested that incarceration in a place where people might reflect on themselves and on their deeds, their actions, their crimes, was a more humane way of addressing social harm. Of course, it didn't really work, though, because very quickly after the creation of the very first penitentiary, which attracted attention all over the world, and people like Charles Dickens came to visit, Tocqueville came. I mean, as a matter of fact, everybody here has probably read Democracy in America. Well, actually, he came to this country to examine penitentiaries, the new prisons. That's why he was here. And in the process, he wrote Democracy in America. This is a very long answer, isn't it?
You have all the time you need, Professor Davis.
But, that's the problem when you've been a professor for so many years. You tend to go on and on and on. But let me see if I can wrap this up. So when we want to challenge that which has become so naturalized, first of all, it's important to look at the history of that phenomenon and to recognize that prisons haven't always existed. As a matter of fact, they're a relatively recent phenomenon, particularly with respect to the imprisonment itself being the punishment. And if we had several more hours, I would talk about how that's related to capitalism. And especially the fact that you are considered to do time in prison. And if anybody has read Marx, you know that the very measure of the value of a commodity has to do with the labor time. So all of these are connected. So it wasn't accidental that the prison as punishment, the penitentiary, emerged in the United States precisely at the beginning of the development of what is seen as a major experiment in democracy, capitalist democracy, I would say parenthetically, because only a minority of the people in this country ever had the opportunity to enjoy the rights and liberties that are detailed in the Constitution. You know, women were excluded, and then not all men, only men who were affluent. So we can see the fact that the institution itself reflects the kind of society that was in the process of being constructed. As a matter of fact, the notion that one could become a better person by learning how to be penitent. And that is the etymological root of the term penitentiary, a place to become penitent. And this was supposed to create better citizens. But women weren't citizens in the first place, so they didn't get to, white women, and certainly not indigenous women or black women. And so you have a situation in which this strange form of punishment becomes institutionalized and then eventually so naturalized that the punishment is so linked to the crime that you assume that people are punished because they commit crimes and not because they are, I mean, they might commit crimes, but a lot of people commit crimes and never even get punished for them. So when you think about the other reasons people end up in the penitentiary or in prisons, it's because of their racial background, it's because of their economic status, et cetera. That's just the beginning of an answer to your question.
I will let him know that you began to answer his question. He'll be thrilled to know. To that end, on the reform part of it, I'd like to ask, there have been some interesting developments recently, relatively recent, regarding incarceration. We have what we've called now progressive prosecutors in certain jurisdictions who are refusing to send people to prison based on different charging criteria. We're seeing some cities and jurisdictions who are trying to get rid of youth incarceration altogether. Hawaii, for one. Do you see these types of changes as meaningful and real? Are they steps on the way to abolition, that process of abolition, or are they Band-Aids?
I mean, it's very interesting, isn't it, that during this period, we see the emergence of what's called progressive prosecutors. I actually worked a great deal with Chesa Boudin, who was recalled from his position as district attorney in San Francisco. And I'm actually still working with him. And he's now has a position at the law school at UC Berkeley. Do you all know who Chesa Boudin is, right? And both of his parents spent time in prison. His father just got out of prison after almost a half a century. And his mother spent some 25 years or so. I mean, I went to school with his mother. I went to high school with his mother in New York. And so I was early on involved in a conversation with both of them when Kathy says to me, Chesa is thinking about running for the office of district attorney of San Francisco. What do you think about that? And my first response was, do you really want to do that? But he was serious, and he had a really interesting strategy that involved using the DA's office to resist many of the strategies that are responsible for what we now call mass incarceration. But of course, as soon as he took office, as soon as he won, the backlash started. We were talking about backlash earlier. And he was eventually removed from that position, although he's doing good work elsewhere. And I don't think he did not see himself as so personally attached to that. But yeah, I like the idea of progressive prosecutors. I don't know whether I would have many years ago, but you know, when I look at what Larry Krasner's done in Philadelphia and what Kim Fox is doing in Chicago, I don't think that by itself that is going to change a great deal. But when you have large numbers of people embracing that position and it is connected with other efforts, then yes, it can make a major difference. In the abolitionist movement, we often make a distinction between what we call reformist reforms and non-reformist reforms. So reforms by themselves decontextualize, don't mean very much. But if they're contextualized within a set of strategies that is designed to move toward abolition, then they can make a major difference. And I, for one, happen to be a person who has learned how not to argue that everybody has to do the most radical thing all the time. There might have been one time. But now I recognize how people also have to do what they love doing. And people who've spent all of this time studying the law, you can't say just, you know, the law is not going to change anything, so you may as well find something else. You know, use your knowledge of the law in ways that are imaginative, in ways that will help push us forward. You know, and I'll just end by saying, when I went to jail and was tried in Marin County up in Northern California, after my acquittal, people were asking me to run for office. And I thought about it for a while. I mean, I didn't take it really seriously. But then I said, well, actually, I might decide to run for sheriff of Marin County. And I might still do that.
Never too late. I wanted to ask you a question about your most recent book, Abolition, Feminism Now. And in it, you write, abolition is unthinkable without feminism, and our feminism is unimaginable without abolition. I was wondering if you could speak to that and tell us more about how those two movements are intertwined.
Well, we wrote a book about that, and it's a collectively authored book. Which was an amazing experience, by the way. If you think writing a book by yourself is hard, try writing it with three other people. But I'll say that, you know, first of all, our notion of feminism is not abstract. It's anti-racist feminism. It's anti-capitalist feminism. It is an engaged feminism. And so when we say that there can be no effective abolition without feminism, we're we're drawing upon the long history of feminist theory and practice that insists on what we now call intersectionality. But of course, that is not the word that we always have to use, because long before Kimberlé Crenshaw introduced the concept of intersectionality in her legal theory, there were those going back to the 19th century who, Anna Julia Cooper, for example, a voice from the South, who insisted that women's rights were Black rights, and that Black liberation would involve women's liberation. So there's so many ways of formulating that sense of deep co-constitution, co-constitutive character of feminism and anti-racism. So what we were specifically thinking about, the fact that one of the major issues confronting feminist communities is violence. You know, what we call gender violence, and that affects not only those who identify as women, but non-binary people as well. We were thinking about the fact that there's a tendency within the established feminist movement to assume that the only way you can prevent this violence is by calling upon the police and by embracing what is sometimes called a carceral feminism. But then if you consider the ways in which gender violence is both involves intimate violence, and it also involves state violence. And both intimate violence and state violence help to reproduce each other. And this is often not recognized when we try to figure out how to end rape and sexual abuse. And, you know, why is the immediate assumption that you have to catch the perpetrator and send the perpetrator to prison, who is then probably going to be subject to forces that reproduce the tendency toward violence? As a matter of fact, quite a number of women who have spent time in prison have pointed out that sexual abuse that happens within intimate relationships or stranger violence feels very much like the violence that one experiences in these institutions of incarceration. And so thinking the two forms, institutional on the one hand and intimate on the other hand, together, helps us think more deeply about what we need to do in order to get rid of violence against women and violence against people of other genders in our work as organizers. It may sound complicated, but what I will say is that the anti-violence movement really can learn from the anti-racist movement. It was really only in the summer of 2020 that huge numbers of people began to recognize that racism isn't about some people not liking other people, that it's structural, that it's institutional, that it's systemic. And gender violence is no different. It's also structural and systemic. That is what we were trying to get at with that formulation. You know, we need feminist insight into abolition, because it was for so long assumed that carceral institutions affected men primarily, people gendered as men, because there are many more men in prison than there are women. But then when you look at the situation of women and non-binary people, trans people, especially behind bars, then you begin to get a sense of what the institution actually does, even though they may not be the majority of bodies behind bars. You begin to understand the institution as what you might call an ideological apparatus, to use the, you know, the term that Althusser used, that it, the fact that there are women's prisons and men's prisons and nothing else has the impact of also naturalizing gender, naturalizing the binary character of gender. Yeah, this is the way this conversation goes. We can go further.
You could write a whole book about it. Believe it or not, we are about to finish the conversation between the three of us and swap over to a Q&A. But before we do that, I have one question that's a very San Diego question. As you know, we are about 20 minutes from the border. As you also know, it's become increasingly militarized. In the last chapter of your autobiography, you shared a quote, "Walls turned sideways are bridges." I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that quote. I love hearing you talk about the importance of imagination in your work, but also to your broader arguments and how we can use what you have learned to create a more humane border.
Well, first of all, I have to tell you that when I wrote my autobiography, Toni Morrison was my editor. She was actually the one who convinced me to write that book, and I'm very happy I was convinced by her to write it, because in the process we became very good friends and remained friends until her death. The reason I say that is because we had come up with aphorisms and epigrams for all of the sections of the book, but not that one. And so Toni made that up. So it appears to be, you know, one of the, you know, kind of proverbs, or, you know, whatever you want to call them, walls turned sideways are bridges. And that's an amazing metaphor, isn't it? It means that we can, with what we have, we can figure out how to create an utterly different kind of relationship with what divided us becoming what unites us. And that has stayed with me all of these years, to the extent that I now often try to emphasize that we cannot assume that the best way to come together is beyond our differences, or, you know, the metaphors that we use, across our differences. And somehow or another, we have to figure out how to get out of the differences. We have to figure out, you know, how to become more alike, which means that we then give up something that's very important. And so now I really like to talk about uniting through our differences and with our differences, that you know, all of these differences can serve as a spark that unites us. And I'm just remembering that I never got to your question about did you just ask a question about the border? Yes. Yeah. Okay, this is what happens when you try to think deeply about issues. You get caught up sometimes in some of the modes of formulation. But all of which is to say that imagining a world without borders is so essential now. Even though we live in these communities that are gathered together under nation states, I mean, whoever said that the most effective mode of human community had to be nation states? Who decided that? That is also connected to capitalism, by the way. And you see so many of these phenomena that are actually consequences of and products, ideological products of capitalism, become so naturalized that we cannot imagine life without them. I imagine a world without prisons, I also imagine a world without borders. Who gets to say who is able to move across this space? And why does it lead to so much demonization and so much, so many efforts to demonstrate that those who wish to cross the border must be inferior because they're not already here? And this has to do with the way in which so many of us, most of us, including myself, have internalized the notion of American exceptionalism. I mean, who said this was the greatest country in the world? So what I will say is that abolition is also about abolishing those institutions, those carceral institutions that keep notions of border crossing alive. And it's the ICE, what we used to call what was it called before? The INS. As a matter of fact, for a long time in the prison work that I've done, INS has been a part of it precisely because of the detention facilities that they have created, the privatization of detention, and so forth. So there's so many issues. But I will also say, if we look at the 1980s, when global capitalism really began to emerge, as capitalism has always been global, but when companies began to cross borders, corporations began to seek cheaper labor, this meant that the previous forms of social welfare began to be contested. As a matter of fact, we began to see privatization of hospitals. I mean, most people here don't even remember when you could go to any hospital anywhere and get treated without being asked, for your insurance card. It's like privatization of prisons. All of this happens when the political economy of the globe begins to shift. And as a consequence, many people lost jobs because they could find cheaper labor elsewhere. And many of those people who lost jobs ended up becoming involved in underground economic ventures, and many of them ended up in prison. So if you want to know why there were more prisons built in the state of California during the 1980s than during the entire period that during the entire previous period, you begin to see how the global economy affects such things as the emergence of what we call a prison industrial complex. So that was happening. Increasing numbers of people of color, increasing numbers of black people and Latinx people were being incarcerated. And at the same time, in countries that are accessible or in countries where the U.S. is relatively accessible, people began to suffer because corporations were moving in trying to make money and people were losing the capacity to sustain themselves. And this happened in Central America, it happened in South America, it happened in Africa. And suddenly, for the sake of more profit, people's lives were being destroyed. And so many of those people who saw their lives crumbling decided to try to make it to the U.S. So that's when you begin to see the migration patterns. The same thing was happening in Europe. But all of it's connected, so that when we talk about challenging ICE, it's very much linked to challenging what we call mass incarceration. And that's just the beginning of a conversation.
Good border conversation. We have a couple of, well, I don't know, probably 36 questions from our audience. We apologize in advance. We probably won't get to all of them.
You see, that's the problem. When you're trained in philosophy, you don't try to take anything for granted. And therefore, the conversations become longer and deeper, which is fun. I enjoy it.
I think we're all enjoying it quite a bit. Thank you. And I'd like to ask you a very nuts and bolts question that's coming from the audience. And it asks, how do you keep your hope alive while fighting for freedom? How do you recommend activists prevent burnout? Or do they?
Well, everybody gets tired. But I think you can avoid feeling like you have to give up. I mean, I'm telling you that as someone who has been involved in Palestine solidarity for many, many years, I am very upset now. It seems as if we're starting all over again, and with all of the ways in which what is happening in Israel and in Gaza is discussed, there seems to be this reversion to this discourse that assumes that a nation state is the answer. And Israel is a nation state like the U.S. is a nation state. And as much as we've criticized the state of Israel, it appears as if now people are arguing that this is the only space to contain one's efforts to end violence. So I say that because I'm feeling really, really upset now. But that happens. That happens. You can't give up. And what I usually say in response to questions like that is that if you want to be involved in movements for social justice, try to discover a way in which you will also be individually fulfilled. Don't just do it as a duty. Find something that you love doing. and that you're not going to, if you are a poet, do it through your poetry. If you, you know, are an intellectual, you know, do it through your relationship to ideas, what you love and what brings you happiness and what brings you a sense of fulfillment. So try to find something that you know you are not just going to leave by the wayside when things get hard, because they will. They will always. And it often feels as if you're repeating yourself over and over again. And yes, you do have to repeat yourself, because sometimes people don't hear you until you've said it 100 times. But you can't give up. You have to continue to say it. Yeah.
Thank you. I think we have time for two more questions. Are you good with that?
Sure.
Yeah? Okay. How do we resist calls to build kinder forms of incarceration while keeping our eye on the long-term goal of abolition? And can you share some examples of alternatives to prison or other carceral systems that give you hope?
You remember I was talking about reformist reforms and non-reformist reforms. Reformist reforms with respect to the institution of the prison tend to create stronger, more permanent, more powerful prisons. Non-reformist reforms tend to be directed toward making life more livable for people who have to, who happen to be in prison at the time, but not rendering that a permanent solution. You know, yeah, you have to ask yourself consistently, is what kind of reform are we pushing for? And how do we prevent the reforms from becoming the framework for a more powerful institution? And that's not something for which there is a formula. Although Critical Resistance, the organization that has a presence online, does have a very interesting chart that you can consult to see what is a reformist reform and what is a non-reformist reform. But I don't know whether there's a formula there. It's a constant conversation that has to be ongoing.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we only have time for one more. And what I'd like to do is in conclusion, ask you a question. One of our incarcerated folks, Carlos, has been probably 27 years in prison. And that's just his last stint, his latest one. And I'm going to put that his question. One, he wants to thank you for the work that you do. And I'm going to read it specifically from him. For making sure young people know about prisons and the indignities of everyday existence here being prison. He says, hopefully none of them ever have to come here. But we do need young people to advocate for us from the outside. And he asks, what actions do you and your students do to help abolish prisons? And it goes along with a question that I wanted to conclude with, that we wanted to conclude with. What would you say are some of the best ways that we could support those who are currently incarcerated? And this is a group of individuals that society often rejects, does not think about, and if they do, they do in a way that is incredibly negative. How can you help us to help them to change that narrative?
Okay, you know, just before I left to come here, I recorded a message for a gala that's happening in San Francisco. It's Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, LSPC. And they've been around for a while, and they've done amazing work. But in the message, I said that what I have been most impressed about over the last decades is the way LSPC, and it has spawned many other organizations. One is called All of Us or None, which is an organization of former felons. They have insisted on the leadership of currently or formerly imprisoned people. They have insisted on egalitarian relationships. Because oftentimes when we think about people in prison, we think about them as people who deserve our help, or people who are in such a bad set of circumstances that we pity them, and we offer our charity to them. You know what I'm talking about, right? And in the process, we replicate the very hierarchies that are responsible for them being there in the first place. So I would say that this is something that everyone can do, is think about and challenge the ideological representation of people in prison that we carry with us, and to recognize that there are people in prison who are perhaps more capable than many of us who live in the free world of doing the work we need to do to change this society. You know, I didn't say a lot about the roots of abolition and the fact that many of these ideas come from people who were or are incarcerated. And, you know, as a matter of fact, there are many new academic fields, critical prison studies, that are being taught all over the country in great universities. And unfortunately, the people who are responsible for the development of these fields are usually people who have been inside. And the kind of intellectual power that has come from people who have no other way to express their humanity, no other way to experience freedom than to do it through the mind. You know, through people who didn't even know how to read and write have learned sometimes in their 20s and 30s how to read and write. And look at Malcolm X. I mean, he's the one we all know about it, but this is a mass phenomenon in prisons all over the country. And so what I would say is that we have to perhaps think more deeply about the ways in which people who have been condemned to that kind of life and who have saved themselves, what they can offer our society. And I want to give you one example of that. And it involves my cousin, who spent 38 years behind bars and got out about 2.5 years ago. He does restorative justice. He learned restorative justice in San Quentin, and he's continuing to do that. Now he goes back into San Quentin to do that work. But this is something that happened to him a little while ago. He's done amazingly well. He has an apartment, he jobs, car, he volunteers, and so forth. But he was out in his car, his new car, one evening, and this man ran a light in the intersection and totaled his car, totally. So Tommy knows restorative justice, right? It turned out the man who total his car was a big time attorney who was driving drunk. And so Tommy approached him and told him that he knew he didn't want to call the cops because that would mean, you know, the end of his career. So to make a very long story short, he told the man, he said, you buy me another car, first of all, right? Second of all, you go weekly into San Quentin prison and you participate in the group of men who have been charged with killing someone while driving drunk. So, I mean, that's kind of amazing, isn't it? And this is how Tommy lives his life now. That for him, and you know, I know this is a school of peace and justice. That is what he does, and that's one example of what the many people who are incarcerated might offer us in our so-called free world.
Thank you for that very, very good example.
And thank you so much for joining us. On behalf of the Clark School and all of the students, we're so grateful that you spent time with us as we learn to train to become agents for peace and justice and equity. And we hope you'll come back.
Listening to today's episode with Wetana Tucker, Professor Angela Davis, and Hallie Schilling. Before you go, we want to hear from you. Share your questions, stories, or ideas on the fires you see in the world today. Contact us on Instagram at crocschool or via email at istheworldonfire@gmail.com and let us know. What is your fire? Today's episode was produced by myself, Hallie Schilling, with special help from Scott Lundergan and Ryan Murphy. It was edited by Jim O'Connell and includes original music by Victor Daniel Castro Escobar. Promotion was made possible by Kevin Dobbins, Tony Campos, and Andrew Byros. Tune in next time.